Hello and welcome to another podcast from the Naval Historical Society of Australia. This is one of the many talks in the archives of the Society recorded over nearly two decades from 1973 until 1980, and now available for you through the Society's website. Today we're listening to Captain L. M. Hinchcliffe, DSC, RAN, talking about his experiences in the pre-war Navy.
Now, Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, there seems to be a bit of controversy about what I'm going to say tonight. I was asked about 18 months ago, I think, by Alan Payne, the secretary at the time, would I write something for the journal? And he immediately bounced and said, no, that I think you ought to talk. And I said, well, what can I talk about? As far as I'm concerned, it's only odds and ends. And he said, oh, well, all right. And then when it was published, and I'm sorry, I haven't got the actual date of the bulletin at my fingertips, but he produced a thing, Odds and Ends, Bits and Pieces. Well, then during this week, I, being a member of the N-Class Association, I got a copy of a thing called Buzz, and that had I was speaking on the N-class destroyers, the history of the N-class destroyers. Tonight, if you please, I did somewhere in one of my pockets, I was presented by the president with a signal that was sent out saying that I was talking about the N-class destroyers in the Mediterranean. Well, I'm sorry, but I'm going to talk. And I don't think it's going to be about N-class destroyers in the Mediterranean or their history. All I hope is that you'll bear with me because it is odds and ends, and I don't know about the bits and pieces at this stage. However, I feel that if you could bear with me and I could run through some of my career, and I have one of my term mates right in front of me here, and alongside him the great Rear Admiral, Musrud, who has already spoken to you and who happened to be my fag at the college. So I've got a couple of people who are thumping right in front of me here. I was one of 12 cadets, we were known as the Cook Year, who joined the RANC in January 1930. It was with some curiosity we met for the first time. In my case, seven of us had entered from Victoria, one each from Tasmania and South Australia, and the rest from New South Wales. We were a very assorted lot as far as size went. Robertson, later to have his name remembered for the first Melbourne collision, seemed enormous, and he was. Whilst I was quite thin, and Bergen from New South Wales was the shortest. He was about 4'5", I think. Our cadet captain, St. Vincent Welsh, who many of you will remember, met us at Central Railway Station and we set off for Jervis Bay. After the train, we really began to see what our new life was to be like. A truck was there to pick us up because the road was muddy and the bus couldn't get through. And in fact, at one stage, we had to get out and push. At supper, one of our members, Jellicoe, put the spoon into the honey pot and produced a mouse. Dead, of course, but what with weevils and the biscuits and the mouse, we really had a first-class welcome to our new life. The biscuits were, of course, really old, hard biscuits. Some of you will remember them. Whitey-grey, XRN stocks, and when you shook the weevil or knocked the weevils out, they weren't so bad. It would have been interesting to have known how old they were. As an aside to that, an engineer officer I served with later, and I'll be mentioning him later on, he actually ate salt pork in 1914, and the barrel was reputed to have 1850 on it. So naval rations on the old hard tack system were pretty long-lasting. We were the last entry at Jervis Bay, and I well remember the Prime Minister, Mr. Scullin, coming down to Jervis Bay with his entourage and viewing the college and cadets. The Depression was still well on, and the £66,000 needed to run the college represented about 1% of the budget at the time. The government wanted to save money, and the college was to be closed. There were two ideas. One was to close it completely, and the other idea was for the cadets to be transferred to the UK and trained there. Fortunately, the captain, Cyril Benson, DSORN, must have impressed on the Prime Minister and his Defence Minister that the college should remain in Australia. And Mr. Scullin announced at Jervis Bay that we would be moved to FND. Entry would be suspended until the financial climate improved. The result of this was that we had an extended first term at Jervis Bay, went off on leave and returned from leave to FND, where we were housed in the Warrant Officers Mess, all 50 of us. Before leaving JB, we held a concert produced by Lieutenant Pearson and had a Banyan funeral march through the college bearing the body of the RANC JB, actually the rugby tackling dummy, on a handcart to its burial in the bush behind the married quarters. Somehow, all the band instruments that had been provided for a college band, I don't think had ever been used, they were all out for that day, green and God knows what, but it was quite a day, I can remember. This concert was the first of many that I was to enjoy in my time. They were a great feature of service life before the war and brought to light an astonishing variety of talent. Perhaps able seaman Ginger Cullen will be remembered by some of you, but he seemed to be always in the forefront if he happened to be in the ship where the concert was being given. FND was a much different life than Jervis Bay. We were restricted in our wanderings, moved information at the double for changes of classroom venue, and even had set routes through the depot. Nevertheless, there were some compensations. We at least saw the sailors under training, took part in those spectacular Trafalgar Day parades, and were seen by the sailors in all aspects of our training. This latter had the effect of the little pigs being encouraged by the lower deck whenever we played the big pigs at football on the ground near the wardroom blocks. The wardroom and the blocks. Incidentally, I don't think any of us had ever heard that expression, pigs at Jervis Bay, being a rather closed establishment. One of my earliest and most embarrassing moments was, or not most embarrassing, but pretty embarrassing, was at the swimming sports at FND. We were all issued in those days, and when I mean lower deck and upper deck, with swimming Vs. For those of us who were reaching mature bodily proportions, they were okay, but for the small ones like me, it was not so. Even sewing across the bottom of the Vs failed to make them fit, and bending over on the starting platform in front of the assembled guests, women and girls included of course, made one very conscious of one's male characteristics being inspected because they were fully exposed to view. These are aspects which could and should have been avoided. For instance, to this day I have a very big bunion caused by a lack of proper sized boots being available in slops. My request to have my parents buy a pair conforming to service pattern was not approved. This is just another example of the lack of thought on the part of some of those in authority. I may say that I now get $5 a week for that, because it happened up in New Guinea during the war when there weren't available size boots. So I got some compensation 20 years later. The term officers during my 4 years in the college were Lieutenant Pearson, Lieutenant Fred Cook, Lieutenant Copper Morrow, Lieutenant Plunkett Cole, Lieutenant Gellatley, Lieutenant Commander Big Bill Stewart, who was later to be known in FND as Giant the Jack Killer, and Lieutenant Commander Miller and Lieutenant Commander Tate and Commander Showers were the officers in charge at FND. Monthly dances to teach us some social graces were held in our dining room on Friday nights for the third and fourth year cadets. One can only say that the wives, girlfriends and other ladies who attended were really doing their duty, because we were mostly self-taught and pretty tongue-tied.
FND provided during this period the only full-scale senior officer's funeral I was anywhere near during the whole of my career. The commander, Commander Curry RN, died and was buried in the depot cemetery. We cadets took part. A gun carriage was hauled by sailors, the proper guards were paraded, the band played the dead march, and we all slow marched from the chapel to the inner depot gate at the guardhouse, broken to the quick, resuming the slow at the cemetery. It was pretty unique for Australia and no doubt exercised the gunnery school pundits' brains. The CO of the school at that time was either Dowling or Armstrong, I think. It was a very moving ceremony, especially when one was young. One amusing incident occurred at the changeover of commanders, surveys and Curry. Surveys was a very tall man, not possessed of much humour, and had a fairly large and flabby son of about 11. Commander Curry was medium to small in height and had very much personality and a great sense of humour. He had two sons about 9 and 10, small and active. When they met young surveys, he informed them he was to be called Master Willie. They looked at one another and then proceeded to deal with him. Very well, it was said. This story was, of course, relayed by the commander's worm basin and was round the entire depot instantly and very much to everyone's delight. Later on, when Cookie and I were doing our gunnery course, Commander Surveys was at excellent, he having been a gunnery officer, and he hadn't changed. He was still completely without humour. At our passing out parade, one of our number was missing, medically unfit. This also was a rather black mark in the treatment of cadets at that time. I won't go into that, but it was a pretty shocking business, really. I should perhaps mention there that we were the junior term for, I think it was 3 years, and then two terms, that's right. And as a result of that, we perhaps missed an awful lot of the joy of the college. I know I have a pretty flat tail these days, and that was belted flat by the term above us as part of the training. But I think that it was much overdone in our day, and certainly was very much overdone earlier on. And later, after we'd left, it was much more humane. Our introduction to seagoing was easy at Jarvis Bay, as we could be placed on board the ships down there for exercises. But at FND, this was not always possible. However, Lieutenant Commander Miller became commanding officer of Tattoo, and Lieutenant Commander Stewart arranged for our year to go out for the day in Port Phillip, and what a day. We weighed the anchor by hand, letting it go again, manning the sea boat, steering, and carried out a lot of simple evolutions impossible to do ashore. We were only 12, remember. But this sticks out in my mind, and no doubt anybody who hadn't had much of that and made the same impression. In January 34, we joined our cruise as Canberra and Australia at the beginning of our seagoing career, and of course the first spit-up of our year. I was appointed to Canberra, the flagship, and I'm certain proved to be a better first training ground than a private ship. By this I mean the command aspects and the ceremonial aspects. You will no doubt remember, some of you of course, no, I didn't realise there were going to be so many ladies here, the officer of the watch in harbour wearing his frock coat and sword belt. If any potentates were to be received, he had his cocked hat, sword, epaulets, and if necessary, gold-laced trousers already on his bunk, and would have to nip below, change, and get back on deck. After the ceremony, he had to revert to normal rig. And this could happen often. And our training for that was that we were allowed 1/2 hour, at least 25 minutes, from the time we were called in the morning to bath, shave and dress, have a cup of cocoa and get on the parade ground. And it certainly stood us in very great stead. Of course, the garden band would often be standing by in the waist, more or less ready for instant parading. Not quite so much in Australia, but later on when we were in the Mediterranean, this was very much the point. Perhaps recalling the harbour routine at the time may stir up memories. Call to hands was at 5:30. Hands fall in at 6 o'clock. All officers were expected to attend. For the Snotties, we had PT conducted by one of the terrible twins, the Grigger twins. They were became quite famous being in the Sydney Emden action. Wallace Grigger was our PTI, and he'd been at the college with us. And his jambok was still active, and we could never dodge it, even as Snotties, or cadets as we still were then. Over the mast head, go, was one of his frequent cries. None of us, of course, were as adept as Larry the Bat, who may come back to memory. Able Seaman Greenhalgh, who could not only get up the mast in record time, but has been seen going along the triatic stay, hand over hand, to retrieve a sleeve target, fouling the stay about 60 feet from the mainmast. In fact, the captain was shattered when he saw that. One of his other tricks was to run along the mess deck table and dive out through the scuttle and open his legs at sea. And he never fell over the side or fell out of it. Going on, we had divisions and prayers every weekday, sit-down church on Sunday, followed by roast pork and apple pie. PT on the upper deck by divisions, preparing for general drill, the apparent chaos for a few hours of general drill. All these things spring to mind, but I always felt that too little time was devoted to explaining to all the new hands what was what at general drill. We suffered from influxes of new hands continuously, and my memory of general drill was that the officers and petty officers carried most of the weight. Later, when Australia had a stable ship's company like the RN on commissions abroad, they became much more understandable and indeed enjoyable. General drill did keep one on one's toes, and by producing friendly rivalry between the tops and ships did much to enhance the efficiency and prevent boredom in those untechnical days. My first cruise with the fleet took us on that hardy annual Hobart, Adelaide, Melbourne, visiting JB at the start and finish. In other words, we showed the flag. But I think most people enjoyed this. One incident still very much in the memory occurred at Hobart. I did not, and still really do not, like dancing. I was detailed to go to the matron's ball in Hobart and found it possible to sneak out for a cigarette about midnight. Next thing, the Admiral was alongside me. "Don't you go much on it either, laddie?" "No, sir," said I. "Well, then get your cap and we'll go back on board." Admiral Dalgleish it was, bluff and looking the old seagog type. He died soon after being relieved by Admiral Randall Ford, who welcomed us years later when we arrived in Malta in 1939. He was then serving in Malta. He was a great man too. But old Bobby Dalgleish may have, some of you older ones may remember him. He was a terrific fellow. Perhaps some may remember the 8-inch full-calibre chute at the old sailing ship Pam, south of Kangaroo Island. She was hit, but the practice projectiles merely hurled her above the waterline, and she was finally dispatched by a demolition party. Well, today, one can think of the uproar that would go on when the coal hulk, it was actually an old clipper, of course, and a rather nice-looking vessel, too, from memory, but that's the way she went. 1934 was the 100th anniversary of the foundation of Melbourne. HRH, the Duke of Gloucester, was to be the King's representative, and he was brought out by HMS Sussex, which ship was to exchange with Australia. We were to proceed to Western Australia to escort Sussex. Of course, much ceremony was to be the order of the day, and intensive training took place, including a march through Perth. We went up to Shark Bay, and at that time we were carrying out soundings, because it transpired that the coast as charted was some 10 miles out for longitude, and the soundings were pretty few and far between anyway. It was during this cruise I had my first flight in the Puss's Duck. Our pilot was suffering a shocking hangover, and the Australia's pilot had to do the job. Knowing him better later, he was probably much in the same condition. In fact, I'm damn certain he was. They're both still alive, by the way. I noted in my journal that we had been promoted to... all right? You got there? I noted in my journal that we had been promoted to midshipmen and were to keep watch as off the watch and the dog watches and mid of the watch and the morning watch, instead of being flung around all day long. My first watch was the day this came into being, and I had 25,000 visitors to get rid of on that Sunday. It shows how keen people were to see us pre-war. This was in the West, and I remember we had to shore up the brow at one stage, and it looked as though it was about to go. Our Royal Guard paraded in Fremantle for the landing of HRH Duke of Gloucester and received very favourable comment, especially from the Guards Band, which was touring at the time. I remember Admiral Ford sending for the gunnery officer a few days before the ceremony, saying it was the worst guard he'd seen. Lieutenant Commander Darling replied that he was very satisfied with it and all would be well. How often has this been the case? Happy Jack has always marched and drilled well at the time of ceremony. I think this is so right, even to the latest one that I marched through Sydney, which I saw on the TV. It seemed to me that, without prejudice, that the sailors were marching far better than the other two services. If there are any representatives of the others here, I don't apologise. I reckon that's true. The Midshipman Canberra went off on leave prior to joining Australia for the Royal Cruise and service with the RN. This was at the end of 34. This cruise produced many highlights. New Zealand I found most attractive and had the fortune to go to Mount Cook area to see the ice, snow and the glaciers. Then Fiji, where the local guard looked tremendous. Those of you who've been to Fiji and seen the local regiment there could never forget them, I don't think. Samoa to Apia, where the escort provided locally was a rather long boats called Fatazis, propelled by about 30 oarsmen who kept stroke on the beat of a drum. Apia was, of course, the scene of the triumph of steam over sail when the old Calliope managed to stand out to sea in a hurricane whilst the French, German and American men of war there were driven ashore. In fact, if I remember rightly, the American ship cleared lower deck and cheered them as they crawled out. Incidentally, anybody who had served round in the South Australian Naval Depot, there was a painting there of this particular incident. It was going to be thrown out, and I don't know which the admiral was who was Foyke at the time, but that when I last saw it, that was in the dining room at Tresco being preserved. There is another story attached to that. The people who looked after us at in the study blocks at the college were known as study corporals, and they dished out the pens and the paper and all the rest of it. And there was one old boy who was reputed to have been in the Calliope. He could well have been. He seemed to be as ancient as the hills. And
He was.
Well, he was always reputed, but he'd never come clean and say so. The only thing he ever did was to spit on his fingers and polish his celluloid collar. After a period.
Yes.
Yeah, he had a period of blank and he came back to us. Conda. Yeah. But he'd never come clean and say he was. He was always round the corner that you heard this. Well, he might have done this one. There's another incident on that at Apia, which still sticks in my mind because it cost me a lot of money. But we were only issued with three number 10 suits. And as some of you may remember, we had to wear those things. And if you were running a motorboat, you had to man the motorboat over the lower boom in your number 10 suit. Well, it didn't last very long. And although we'd had this small gap between Fiji and Samoa, the cooks had been working overtime on somebody else's clothes as far as my mind were concerned, and I had to go down to the foot of the gangway. It was an open roadstead and the ship was rolling pretty heavily, and we were giving a reception on board, and there was some old chief who was reputed to have 55 wives, and he looked big enough to carry the whole lot in his two arms, but he was pretty flabby in the legs, and there was the cruiser rolling back and forth, and I had to help him out, and I was doing the sideboy act at the lower level of the starboard ladder, when the ship took a very good roll indeed, and I finished up that deep in water with the chief on my shoulders. Having changed that suit, I repeated the deal about 10 minutes later with somebody else. But after Apia, we were to pass through the Panama Canal and on to Jamaica and the Bahamas, and I can't remember this, but I think Bermuda was also on it. Is that right? And this didn't come to pass. An American four-masted schooner called the Seth Parker caused that to be changed. She made, finally, at our request, an SOS, and we steamed to her through a best part of a hurricane. Although we took off 9 of a crew of 14, the others refused to go, and we were rather forced to stand by until a tug ordered from Pango Pango arrived. Observing that we had the King's representative, or the head of the whole empire's representative on board, I don't think the world was terribly impressed with the proceedings of Seth Parker. I did note in my journal that she was somewhat flimsy. I've forgotten now what the construction of the timber was, but whatever it was light, and she started to draw the chain plates, and that's what made them finally send the SOS. But nevertheless, the team we brought on board, having been represented as young Americans of good family, were mostly pretty scungy. One other amusing incident, as far as I was concerned, whilst we were standing by this thing, was being a keen fisherman at the time, I was trying for sharks. There were plenty around. And I got a couple, and the gunnery officer, who was Lieutenant Commander Buchanan, later Admiral Buchanan, came up and saw me with quite a reasonable one on it, and HRH happened to be looking as well. He said, "Well, I'll go and get a rifle and shoot it." And HRH said, "No, you'll shoot through the line." And my God, he did. Couldn't have been a better shot. Instead of hitting the shark, the line, and I lost a lot. Just after we left them, we had a very elaborate crossing the line ceremony, fairly understandably because HRH was on board, and I thought I was going to get out of being dunked and bunked and all the rest of it because I was on watch, but the officer of the watch decided to release me for my chores, and I was duly put through the mill. When we finally got to Jamaica, we'd been 28 days at sea, which is a record for peacetime in those days, and I think was only broken a couple of times during the war, if then. One of the colony-class cruisers may have done it on two occasions in the Atlantic. The passage through the canal was most interesting, and one other thing perhaps for those who like their food was we were pretty low, of course, in food, and we got into the canal, and we fueled and stored at the Balboa, and part of the food asked for was so many cases of God help us, I just slipped this one. Oh yes, beg your pardon, of lamb's fries. And some farmer amongst the lower deck was looking at was a part and parcel of the storing team. Apparently he had a look inside one of these cases, and there was very nearly an uproar through the whole lower deck, because the lamb's fry in American parlance is the lamb's testicles, and the troops were not going to eat lamb's testicles even if they were forced to. The passage through the canal was most interesting, and our arrival at Kingston, Jamaica was very welcome, and they also made us very welcome. It was the most historic place insofar as the Navy was concerned. Port Royal, the old port, was submerged in an earthquake about some 100 years beforehand, but you could still see some of it from the surface. Also, the local cathedral was paved with the tombstones of people who'd been buried there, including one Admiral Benbow, who'd had a great victory over the French in that part of the world. As our visits to these other islands have been cancelled, because we had to arrive in England and Portsmouth on one day only, because that was the only day the King had set aside to welcome his representative from touring the Empire. We had a longer stay in Jamaica than actually scheduled. But when we did set off for England, the passage was marred by a hell of a gale, and later by fog, which nearly actually beat our arrival time. However, we did arrive on time, and there on the wharf to greet us were the Prince of Wales and the Duke of York in person, which was a great thrill for everybody. After all that ceremony was over, leave was granted, and long leave was granted, and the refit started to fit the ship with a catapult. Can you hear all right at the back there? In May, we left for the Med, calling at Gibraltar, where I had another salutary lesson. We were paid, and Jellicoe and I went ashore and went into one of the hotels, and 20 minutes later, I went home. I lost all my money in the fruit machines, which are now called poker machines. And by crikey, I've never forgotten that. I don't play them. We joined the 1st Cruiser Squadron when we got to Malta and proceeded to get down to the training, because we'd done virtually nothing whilst we were on the what became to be known as the Royal Booze. In Malta, I had the doubtful honour of setting the C&C back in his heels when he talked to the midshipman after inspecting the ship. And this is why I know so much and like Malta. I'd had my leave stopped for some ruddy thing or other, and this was the end of the first week there, and I hadn't been ashore. And he rattled along the lot of us. What do you think of Malta? What do you think of Malta? Of course, all the people, we're in order of seniority, all the more senior ones, they were tongue-tied, and it came down to me for some reason or other. I said, haven't been ashore, sir. No. Leave stopped or not sufficiently interested? Not sufficiently interested, sir. I don't know why I said not sufficiently interested, because the leave stop would have been perfectly all right. And that really rocked old William Wordsworth Fisher. And the commander was Admiral Farncombe, or Commander Farncombe. He said, I think you'd better see this young gentleman learn something about Malta, Commander. And I had to write a 3,000-word essay on it, but it was well worth it. Malta is a most interesting place in every way. And I think that too few of us really realise it. It's a great pity that they've opted out of the good relations with us, because, as you know, so many of the of our canteen people in the RAN were all Maltese. And think of old Jesus Zammit, who helped so many people, and without getting anything really in return, but he never saw anybody, whether they were upper deck, lower deck, or whatever. Never saw them in a hole. He was always there to help. And likewise, most of the others. However, that's quite an aside, and I hope one of these days to be able to go back to Malta. After more exercises, we returned to the UK for the Jubilee Review, which took place in Spithead, the actual review being on the 16th of July, 1935, from the Royal Yacht Victoria and Albert. That collection of ships will never be surpassed, in my view. 23 submarines and 4 submarine tenders, 70-odd destroyers, 20-odd cruisers, 12 capital ships, 2 carriers, 30-odd large merchant ships and a host of other craft, surveying vessels, hospital ships, depot ships, minesweepers, etc. 161 ships in all. and they also had three little bays for dockyard craft to anchor in. It was a tremendous sight. We had the honour of having HRH, the Duke of Gloucester, on board. He actually wrote to the ship and said, please could he be at the review in the Australia and not in the Royal Yacht, which of course we took up right away. And that night he invited his three brothers over. And it was, when one looks back on that, it was a great, great honour for the RAN to be visited by all four sons of the King. We extinguished ourselves that night, and I say extinguished because this is a good old gunnery expression. The ceremonial at night was a searchlight display, and you can imagine what that was like from all those ships. I don't suppose a real searchlight display has been seen in Australia since about 1934 in Melbourne. But that was on for something like 15 minutes, then there was darkness for some time, and then all the sailors manning the side had flares which they struck and everything else. We made a cadorna, and it was quite obvious who it was. But because we'd had this royalty on board that night, I think we got away with it without any great bottles from the CNC present, including the King himself. After the review, the Australia went to dry dock for repairs and final fitting of the catapult. During this period, Italy and Abyssinia locked horns, and on our return to the Med, it was to find us virtually on a war footing. The Med fleet was reinforced, and the first cruiser squadron finally consisted of 9 cruisers. Incidentally, I have got, I dredged it out of the bottom of a box, my old photograph album, and there are a couple of photographs in there that I think might be well worth seeing of this first cruiser squadron. That will never occur, it didn't occur again, and of course it will never occur again, these set piece manoeuvres and so on, but there are one there in the three divisions. During our period in the first CS, the Australia won the regatta 2 years in succession, a feat that had not been achieved for 70 years. We did well in sailing, cricket, rugger and boxing, and in general drill as well. And as far as I don't know how many bunting tosses are here tonight, but we also were so well up in semaphore that we were made of one of the relay ships, because Alexandria Harbour, where we were lying, as some of you will know, was pretty long, and that nearly drove our bunting tosses into the ground. They were doing so much relaying. These days, of course, you touch type and all the rest of it, there's no problem, but it was then. Sydney had joined the fleet, and together we visited Gallipoli. This was most interesting, especially the well-kept cemeteries. I don't know how many of you have been to Gallipoli, but at that particular time, there was a complete contrast between these well-kept cemeteries, which were beautifully kept, the memorials were good, and what had not really been, for want of a better term, sifted over. I can remember seeing a shell crater, not very deep, of course, by this time, but the clothing and bones were round it, where they'd had gone in amongst the men and they hadn't ever been scraped up, as you might say. Shells, shrapnel shells, there's a great lump of a 15-inch, the only 15-inch battleship there, of course, was Queen Elizabeth. And this is about one-third of one of her shells. The marking's quite clear. And round in Anzac Cove, or on that side of it where they landed, were still the old barges. And later on, when I was NOIC New Guinea, I was reminded of this because all through New Guinea, the old rotting steel barges. But the Young Turks took us through there. There was absolutely no animosity. They really reckoned that they'd had a good adversary in the Anzacs and the British and French. And as you all know, it was so close to being a victory that it was pathetic. And I must admit that I'm very, very pleased I saw that. We had two people on board who had been in the landing. One was a schoolmaster whose name completely... And the bandmaster. He said, Friar Tuck, because of his great point. Yeah, grand old boy. And the bandmaster, not the bandmaster, the band Harry corporal. Blaskett. Harry Blaskett. So it was even more to the point that for them. Pierce. Schooley Pierce, wasn't it? Well, one of the things too was right outside, I went on the second day, right outside one of these beautiful cemeteries, the hedge neatly trimmed and all the rest of it, were a couple of shin bones and a couple of skulls. I'm not too certain that some of the sailors haven't cooked this up the day before, but that's the state of the peninsula in those days. I have noted here, and one of the other incidents that I took part in was a fellow called Mitchman Cook. And he and I drove the Cairo Alexandra Express one afternoon, paying 20 cigarettes for the privilege and having to hide at every signal box we passed. Co-driver. Finally, the Abyssinian affair folded and the Australia and Sydney were scheduled to return home. We Snotties were shifted to Devonshire and London, and the ships departed for Australia on the 14th of July. We were gave the ship a chair, and by crikey, the commander turned the whole of the ship's company around and gave us a chair back, which was very impressive to our new ship, I must admit. And that particular day signalled the breakup of the reinforced Med fleet. The ships started to go back to their old stations, Berwick back to China, Exeter back to South America and so on. But in Devonshire, we next found ourselves in Spanish waters evacuating people from the revolution there. Marseille was the place where we went mostly. And we had our first air raid in Palma, Mallorca. I was in a bar at the time and heard this aircraft overhead, and the next thing, a thump. I must have been pretty small bomb, because they did some damage with no casualties. But nevertheless, I can look back on that in 1936 as the first air raid I took part in. We were off Valencia for some days, and one of our duties as Snotties was to take the guard at Colours at 8 o'clock in the morning. And at Valencia, this became quite a chore, because there were American, Russian, German, and you name it, they were all there. I think there was something like 12 nationalities represented in the roadstead off Valencia. And at Colours, one played the King first, or if you were a German, you played Deutschen Buber Alles first, and then off you went in the order of seniority of the commanding officers or admirals present. And it was a pretty long and grueling job. Nevertheless, the band put up a jolly good concert, and we learnt something, at least what the other national anthems were like. The Spanish Revolution at that stage went into a bit of a decline, and as far as sea activity is concerned, although I think we did see one destroyer action in the Straits, didn't we, on the way through. Not hitting either side, but lots of splash and froth and bubble. And we went back to in the Devonshire to pay off. We had our seamanship exam there and we all passed and duly reported to the Greenwich Naval College for the start of our courses. Greenwich Naval College really was the university of the Navy. And to a degree it still is. I think they've got the nuclear section there at the moment. Very old, had been a palace. If anyone goes over to London and has the time to go down there and have a look at the Painted Hall, it is fantastic. It was under repair when we were there, so we didn't dine in it. But in 1975 I was over there and I attended a ball there and I really saw it in its magnificence, and I recommend it. Our courses were over in 1937 and I returned and joined Swan late in the year. Cookie was in Yarra. The year and 3 months in Swan were very happy ones as far as I was concerned. We were training reserves and had much reduced ship's company. As a result, much more devolved on those delivering, as you might say, to between ports. For instance, there were four of us in the forecastle coming alongside. I threw a heaving line and passed a 6-inch manila, put it onto the drum of the windlass, and then the chief stoker backed it up with one hand and drove the windlass with the other. And the other two hands handled the steel spring. One thing in particular, going up the Brisbane River, which was pretty boring on the forecastle, we used to have competitions with heaving lines, and even to this day I'm not bad with the heaving line. As the only one signalman was born, the officer watch did the signalling. Indeed, one watch going over the bight, it was so rough that the helmsman, the only one in the wheelhouse at the time, was too sick to steer. So as officer watch, I was helmsman. We had bridge steering, which we could connect up for minesweeping in that ship, and signalman, and of course the lookout as well. It was a pretty lively situation. Incidentally, one Petty Officer Hayes, who some of you may remember, Tubby Hayes, he lost 7 pounds weight in the 6 days we took to cross the bight. And you may also remember when Uncle Hal hoisted take up preliminary A formation. This is minesweeping, and we could just see one another over the waves. And Roy Darling, our captain, scratched his head, and he said, How many of those not under command balls have we got, signalman? He said, three. So he said, hoist them up. That was his answer. There was no signal other than two. So after the September 38 crisis, which occurred when we were in Fremantle, we in Swan went off to Shark Bay. By this time we had 2/3 ship's company of permanent personnel, and to clean up and prepare for unveiling the Dampier Memorial in Broome. Now you recall back in about 1628, Dampier, RN, sighted the coast and landed in the vicinity of Broome. Well, I don't know who it was, but apparently from about almost the beginning of the century, they've been trying to get someone to get up there and unveil this a memorial, which was actually a concrete... wasn't a replica, it was bigger than a sea chest. And it just went on and on and on and on. And finally the whole of our program, of course, fell apart at the seams when the crisis came on. So we were diverted to go up there and provide the unveiling party. Well, we went into Shark Bay, and believe it or not, we actually trained our guard on the sand. And we had a bugle on board, but no bugler. So the chief, who was, amongst other things, quite a reasonable musician, he got hold of a piece of copper tube and gradually whittled it down until the steward, who could play a cornet, was able to beat out the last post on that. And that's how we went off. We dressed him as a sailor for the day as well. When it was all over, I retired to the RSL, which is a hut about 20 by 10, to be greeted with, "Done like a guardsman, sir," from, believe it or not, a retired major in the Guards. That was quite a day. I might say that whilst the Bishop of the Northwest and the Captain were speaking, the dogs well and truly lubricated that sea chest. With all the guard could do from bursting into laughter. The other highlight of Broome was in the last night. We had been quite well received there, and I was just about to walk down that long jetty when I heard a groaning in the grass of the small naval cemetery at the end of the jetty. On inspection, it was Able Seaman Sutton. He was quite out to it, and as this was the last boat ever, I struggled with his weight, hoisted him on my shoulders and staggered off down the jetty. Fortunately, about halfway down, Gentleman Tom Barrett, whom a lot of you will remember, came running up and took over. He was grateful for the delay because he would have missed the boat too. Tom Barrett, I'd served about four times with him, and he finally finished up as assistant canteen manager over in Penguin with one chief rider, Gilly Bantoft. But Gentleman Tom was known as that because every port he went to, the most striking girl that came on board, beautifully dressed, was always his auntie. We moved off from Broome to anchor in the middle of the Timor Sea to stand by for the long-range Wellesley bombers. Three of them took off from Egypt. If I remember rightly, the course to be taken was to Darwin was pretty nearly 8,700 miles. And it was by far the most ambitious thing for three of them to do. And we were sent up there, and we anchored in the middle of the Timor Sea. And if they called up, we were to make smoke so that they could see us. And if they were about to ditch, they could head towards us, at least head towards our position. And if they saw the smoke, land. We didn't have very long to wait, but there was tons of activity because there were sharks in hundreds. There were a lot of good fishermen in the ship. And I suppose I've never seen them like it. I was using a 2.5-pound line, which you may remember is 20 fathoms. And there were little ones about 10 feet down, there were bigger ones about 20, and you can go on, and they were even underneath my bait at 120 feet, clear as a bell. Arch Harrington, who was our number one, he used a trout rod, and even he managed to land a three-footer. But most of us only got the heads and a small piece of the guts back. We then moved off to meet these fellows who had done their long-range flight, and they were very good blokes indeed. And off we went for Sydney. We were due to be inspected on return, and it was decided to shake out all the moths from the awning, or the canvas room, and we came in wearing our awnings, which in those ships were double for the tropics. They were most effective. We had them spread all the way down from our anchorage in the Timor Sea to Sydney. It didn't go down very well with the Admiral, I must admit, but it went down well with us. The next year, I went off to HMAS Adelaide, who was nearing the end of her modernisation, which was, of course, part-only refit. She was converted to full oil burning and given some 4-inch guns, HA guns. We worked up at Jervis Bay and then took part in an exercise when part of the fairing fell off into the and jammed itself in between two propeller blades. We were doing 25 knots at the time and nearly shook the tripod foremost right out of it. And we came back to Sydney on one propeller, went into dry dock, and of course, wouldn't you know that it dropped off on the way home. But she paid off about a month later, and I went off to the Vendetta as number two. She was running for the AS school and was out 4 days a week. Quite an easy berth to fill. I was navigator, Seaman Communication, Cooks and Stewards Divisional Officer, the CB Officer, which is confidential books, the ship's office, the wine cater, and anything else they could find out. And I got ashore once a week. Everyone else was married. But nevertheless, it was quite an interesting period. We were lying off Sydney on patrol when war was declared, but we had already a week before really started our own participation in it. The Lahn, a German merchant ship, cleared out of Port Jackson about midnight on the Friday night. The wharfies declared they had seen 6-inch guns below and that there were signs of mounting rings on deck. Vendetta had steam in all three boilers for safety valve lifting trials, and it also had two new rows of turbine blades fitted, which would be tested too on the Saturday. I was sent for by the captain in charge, Captain Henry Phillips, RN, and asked if we could go to sea in a hurry to search for Lahn. Explaining that we were short of seamen, and gunnery rates in particular, he said, well, get what you want from the crew of Australia. She was nearing the end of her big refit at that time, and they were housed in Penguin. To their amazement, I got sufficient ratings. Some of the captain number one and gunner, and at 9:30 we slipped. We made 18 knots to Bradley's Head, 24 knots to the Wedding Cake, and cleared the heads at 28. Our task being to find and shadow Lahn until relieved. Hobart's Duck was sent up to help too. About 1800 I endeavoured to fix the ship and found we were ahead of DR. The captain had already said if we did not sight anything by dark, about 1815 we would return. We could not communicate with GI, which was the communication centre in those days. We turned back and then it started. It was so rough that I was the only officer on his feet. Captain was out in his sea bunk. You couldn't call it a sea cabin, it's about that wide. Number one was flattened in his bunk, and I wrapped the rangefinder cover around the gunner T on the after end of the bridge. He didn't even know I'd done it. After 16 hours on the bridge, guns relieved me, but in the meantime I'd had to leave the bridge to rescue get the anchor reset in its horse pipe, and I had to leave the leading signal as the officer of the watch. When we returned to harbour, all we heard from the Australia was, lose yourselves or forgot your sextant. It was a beautiful day near the coast, but all hill about 20 miles out. That has been so often the case that it's surprising it's not written up in the Met books. I've often had that since. The people I served with in my two small ships were great shipmates and all did well. Swan produced two rear admirals, two vice admirals who became CNS, and several promotions from the lower deck. Vendetta produced a couple of captains and several promotions from the lower deck, including one commander. The engineer officer in Swan and later in Vendetta with me, Alec Nairn, had fought in HMS Kent at the Battle of Falkland Islands and had also served in submarines in that war, and in the first O-class we had out here. He was a terrific fellow in every way. Alec has been classified by two senior officers as being the best shipmate they'd ever served with. And then going to the lower deck, there were a tremendous number of marvellous blokes there. Gilly Bantoft I've already mentioned, Gentleman Tom, Barrett, Lionel Locke. Going back earlier, I couldn't miss out on our term chief petty officer at the college, Lyke Thomas, who, when we didn't know he was going to the Garden Island paying off from the Navy, and the first thing we knew, we were at studies in the study thing, and a head came through the scuttle, got any overalls? It was old Lyke Thomas. And perhaps the finest fellow that I knew in my time in destroyers. There were two who stand out tremendously in my view. This one that I will mention tonight is Arch Bradley, who was our coxswain in Vendetta. A colossal fellow. A lot of you will remember him. And Arch was the fellow who occupied the cabin next to me, up forward under B gun. It was known as the, thank you, known as the flotilla sick bay. And the coxswain used it. I had the other one. And the gun support for B had the, B gun had an opening into my cabin, not into his. And of course, it also had an opening in the galley flat below. And old Arch used to hold coxswain's defaulters every morning down there. "You little bastard," here, bang. Never got aft. But they all respected him, and it was all, we all knew it went on, and he really was. Even I was a little bastard from time to time, sir. No, they were great days, and I very much enjoyed my pre-war Navy. And thank you very much for bearing with me. This is the... sorry, Lou, but... This is the album. I believe we haven't got it. We do, I don't realise. But there, if you can see it, there are nine cruises of information. I've got several others of these going around. And there was three cases of 8-inch cruiser there, the Kents, which the Treasure and Council were, the Devonshire, London, Sussex, which was a London class, the Exeter, which was a 6-gun 8-inch cruiser, and then there was Sydney and Ajax, two different classes of 6-inch cruiser. But to see them manoeuvring was something tremendous, and I'm very, very pleased that I've got this memory back all those years, because one never saw it again. They never had a collection of cruisers like that again. Anyway. Well, if anybody would care to come up and to look at these things, I'll stand by to explain them. Thank you very much again.
Well, thank you, Captain Hinchcliffe, and for a very personalised, very detailed and very interesting address.
I hope it wasn't too personalised.
Well, personally, and I think I speak to everybody here, I'm pleased that you stuck to your guns and gave us bits and pieces rather than the Lincoln End class and the Mediterranean. I think we've learned a lot, and we've really got something tonight which is not written in the history books, and we appreciate it very much. And I'm now going to call upon Rear Admiral Musseter to be a Vader thing on behalf of all those present.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, Hinch. I think it's probably more proper that I should do this rather than his term mate Bill, because I can give the other side of the coin in some respects. I first met L.N. Hinchcliffe on, I think it would have been the 21st of September 1932. We'd been met in Melbourne by two gentlemen called Fowle and Sitt, chief cadet captains responsible for us on our entry into the Navy, who took us down to FMD, and we had a week with them before the body came back from leave, taught something about it. And I think it was on the 21st of September, roughly, that a gentleman introduced himself to me as Hinchcliffe, and you're my fag, well, he's told you this. There was also a senior fag. He was second fag to a gentleman called Maxwell. However, he did happen to mention that they had a couple of years as the juniors, 2 years and two terms. What I might say, perhaps, is that in that one term that we were the juniors, they made up for that 2 years and two terms. And what indeed happened was that in January of 1933, the next 12th came in, and they had two junior terms then, so they kept up the good work. We had a peculiar institution down there known as the Friction Library. The Friction Library was indeed the Fiction Library, but it was used by the senior term every Sunday night to whistle us up, tell us what we'd done wrong that week, and deliver punishment. Might have been with a hairbrush, might have been with a gin chill. He always dealt with me because I was his fag. However, it went on and on and on, and he departed to college and did all these, from college and did the things he told us about. And I really didn't catch up with him, except very occasionally until after the war, in fact, in Sydney in 1945, probably, when I started sailing with you in March. And then our friendship started properly. It was a friendship, strangely enough. And we served together, and Harry here will remember in Tobruk the famous saying, "Christ, one, you can't do that," which was me telling me as the engineer. And as a result of that little lot, Max became godfather to my first son. And the friendship has continued and continued. I think, quite frankly, as Lou said, I'm pretty pleased in the way that we've had bits and pieces tonight, odds and ends, because I think reminiscences have got an awful value. They make us start thinking. Things we've forgotten, little things come out. It makes us possible to tie a couple of things together which might have been not properly put together in our own minds. And for this reason, I think it's been very, very valuable, Max. I've enjoyed it. Lots of things there. I don't agree with you on everything, but does that
matter? Yeah, it did.
here are us, what in my mind, this gentleman, Wallace Grigger, whom I love like a father in some place, and he would call me Mr. Muzzyhead. I went to see, now the heart for our day is Mr. Muzzyhead. It took me years to live it down. But I think Wallace's favourite trick in our time, the FND, was we're in the drill hall near that big Asheville parade ground, and the grass was over there, and if he was displeased, "Right, clear, bruv, get it, fetch it, and sit on it." And my crikey, if you were the last one there, you went back and got another like a grass. And he had us under control. Max, I'm not sure about 28 days at sea. I do have a feeling that the destroyers, including some of the ends, did longer than that at the tail end of World War II. But I'm not sure.
That's unsupported.
Yeah. Yeah.
That 28
But I would
days.
Say for a cruiser, certainly it was.
Unsupported, yeah. 28 days.
The other thing, which I think to add to it, I had the great fortune to be in the painted hall for two official occasions. I was invited there when I was at Australia House, and I sat at the high table at a dinner with the First Sea Lord and with the whatnot for the Navy, the Seventh Sea Lord, and others. And I was also there for a ball. And I think the ball was the highlight of my life, because there was this beautiful ball with the painted ceiling and how many 169 and a half tits up there? Was it? But you had the marble columns at the side, you had the black and white marble mosaic tiles on the floor and so forth. And the admirals all circled around the inside of the music. The captains were going here and there, slap bang in the middle of the two midshipmen doing rock and roll. That was in 1964. And I think that's the best thing I've ever seen. Anyway, again, thank you, Max. I hope everybody's enjoyed as much as I have. They should have. But don't forget, you've got to come back and give that one about the end some other time.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you're looking for more information about Australian naval history, then you should use our website. You'll find more podcasts, articles from our quarterly in-house magazine, Naval Historical Review, and a range of e-books, monographs, and ships' plans for sale in our online shop. If you have any questions or research inquiries about Australian naval history, then feel free to contact us. Use the link on the website homepage. The Society is a not-for-profit organisation which relies on your continuing support. Please use our website links to become a member, or donate now, or sign up as a volunteer, or subscribe to our newsletters. See you next time.